Our founding fathers gathered in taverns to enjoy lively political conversation over a local brew, and so do we. It's Pints and Politics, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday evening, we gathered at CSPS in Cedar Rapids to talk politics with Gazette columnists Todd Dorman and Adam Sullivan, as well as political reporter James Lynch and our special guest Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. We began with some of the latest in national news and then touched on what our lawmakers here in Iowa have been doing as the 2018 legislative session winds down. Pints and Politics, just ahead. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Our founding fathers gathered in taverns to enjoy lively political conversation over a local brew, and so do we. It's a special Pints and Politics edition of River to River, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Today, coming to you from CSPS in Cedar Rapids, I'm Ben Kiefer.
And I'm Aaron Jordan. And we've got Todd Dorman. He's our opinion and insights editor. We've got James Lynch, he's our political reporter for the Gazette, and we've got Adam Sullivan, opinion columnist.
We have a special guest, though, Aaron, this evening on River to River. People will know her as one of our most popular analysts on Politics Wednesday, department head and professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Let's welcome Donna Hoffman. So let's, shall we start off with Donna, and then we'll kind of groove into the rest of the panel here. Donna, we wanted to talk specifically about a seminar you're teaching this semester. As I look out over our crowd of a couple hundred people, I see the demographic, well, let's just say it's not an undergraduate demographic out there. Right. So what I want to go to you for is to tell us about the seminar and how younger people are sort of receiving, digesting the very interesting political times in which we live.
So we make all of our seniors take a seminar before they leave. We want to test what they know, if you will. And we rotate that through various faculty. And one I teach is called Reforming the Republic. And so during the semester, we expect these students to know various things because they've been through our classes, but we think about the founding of the United States in this class. We think about the theoretical foundations, what we call classical republicanism, which is kind of that public good and public spiritedness and duty element that we're supposed to have in our democracy, and also the classical liberal element in our democracy as well, which is the individual aspect, the American dream aspect, the capitalism aspect of our founding. And so that's kind of our framework. And then we discuss various issues every day in which the students lead discussion. It's usually a pro-con type of situation where we're taking some reform that someone has talked about in the American system, and it might be, should we have a line item veto? It might be, should members of Congress have term limits? It might be, should we get rid of the Electoral College? Things that have been kicking around out there for quite some time, typically, that have definite sides to them, and the students study those sides and go in depth on them. And in particular, for our purposes, we want them to look at what do political scientists know about these particular issues. One I might use as an example here are term limits. Public opinion shows that 80% of the public think that members of Congress ought to have term limits, for example. And our students, generally think that too. But if you look at what political science research says about term limits, it probably is not actually what you want. Now, we can test this because about 15 states over time have had term limits, and we can look at what their effects are. And actually, we know that where in states that have adopted term limits for state legislators, power actually devolves to the executive branch. So you think you're doing this service, right? You want citizen legislators. Well, their expertise is going when they go as well. And who has the expertise that stays from term to term to term to term. It's the people in the executive branch of that state. So it may not actually be what you think it is in terms of a reform.
Should we talk about the testimony by, is he still the richest man in the world? I don't know. No?
I don't think so.
No, okay. Well, we'll still give him some air.
He's probably the richest man in the world who wears hoodies frequently.
All right. Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook CEO, testified 2 days, quite different days, I have to say, before a House Energy and Commerce Committee regarding Facebook's the company's use and protection of user data. I would like to find out some of the takeaways that the panel has from that, because let's just do this. Before we go to the panel, I would like to employ one of our things we can do with our audience of a couple hundred people here at CSPS in Cedar Rapids, a little bit of a clapping poll. Clap if you are an active Facebook user. Wait, by that, I mean you use it perhaps at least once a day or once a week. Clap if you're an active Facebook user. Okay, now clap if you, because of Cambridge Analytica and what we found out about the data breach, if you're rethinking your activity on Facebook because of that news, clap if that's the case. All right. Clap if, this is going to be probably a small number, if you've deactivated or even gone as far as deleting your Facebook account because of this data breach. A little bit of a prelude to get our audience involved there. Panelists, your takeaway from Mark Zuckerberg being hauled, let's just say hauled before Congress. It sounds sort of medieval when I say it that way, right?
I followed it pretty closely. I think it was the Senate on
Adam
Tuesday
Sullivan.
And the House on Wednesday. One takeaway I have is I pretty much every congressperson that had an opportunity to speak did indicate they would like to see some more government regulation or oversight over social media in general, and in particular Facebook, because it is the biggest social network. But what was really interesting to me is that there were a lot of different issues at play. So you saw a lot of the Democrats were concerned with the Cambridge Analytica stuff, but then you saw Republicans were concerned with a whole different set of issues, including censorship of right-wing groups on Facebook. So Senator Ted Cruz and Senator Ben Sasse had comments to that effect. So it does seem like Congress might try to put some rules forth. I don't know if those look like what a lot of the critics want them to look like, though. Obviously, Republicans are in charge. So I'm not sure how that'll all pan out. But it was interesting to me that there wasn't really one single reason why they called this these hearings. There were really a lot of issues at play.
James Lynch.
I didn't follow it real closely, but what I took away from news reports is, you know, sort of what Adam was saying, there didn't seem to be a real common theme that people were looking for different things. Some were concerned about having a monopoly, and I think there are probably a lot of people who sort of embarrassed themselves with questions they asked or made their staff members cringe with some of the questions they asked, especially like when they asked Zuckerberg, like, can you explain why my VCR keeps blinking 12?
One caveat to that point, there certainly were examples of that, and I actually have a column in Friday's Gazette going over this, but I actually thought Chuck Grassley, who happens to be the second oldest member of the Senate, his comments were actually pretty spot on. So he pointed out a lot of things that other senators and representatives didn't seem to understand. And one really important piece of that Chuck Grassley made clear is that no one pays for Facebook, right? So this personal data that you hand over to Facebook through using Facebook, that's how they make their money. So there's a possibility that maybe there could be a pay-to-play model for social media moving forward, but if people don't want to pay for it, but they still want to be on social media, there's really not another way to fund it without collecting that personal information.
Which prompts me to ask the audience, how many of you would be willing to pay for a social media like Facebook with the promise that your data wouldn't be sort of harvested the way it is by Facebook right now? Would you be willing to pay for it? Okay. Fairly stingy crowd out there.
Conservatives.
Pretty stingy panel, too.
Todd, did you have anything where you wanted to add something?
Well, I mean, I think it's been covered pretty well. As long as you get this for free, I mean, they're going to mine your data and they're going to use that to sell advertising, and that's the way it is. You know, as someone in the newspaper business, I'm not sure people want to pay for digital content, it's always kind of a difficult sell. I mean, it's, you know, people get something for free for a long time, and then you try to charge them for it, and that's difficult. So I'm not sure that this will lead to some great changes with Facebook and government regulation. I mean, this is a Congress that doesn't get a lot of stuff done and can't agree on even sort of more simple things than regulating social media, which is incredibly complicated. So I'm skeptical that there will be much regulation, but maybe technology in some way will take care of this as we move forward.
I was listening to a report on NPR on my way up here. Someone was saying they had looked at Facebook's FTC filing from a few years ago, and it was the cost for each person, each user per year, I think, was something like 20 cents for Facebook to put this together. So it seems like the cost, if there was a pay model, wouldn't have to be exorbitant, but maybe like you were saying, Todd, maybe it's still too much. I wanted to move into the topic of the Syria and the reports that there have been chemical weapons attack this week. And so it's prompted some kind of tough talk from President Trump, but some talk that's kind of confusing, going in different directions. So I wanted to ask you, Donna, since this is your specialty, do you think his actions are going to be reflected in this rhetoric, or what do you see there?
I don't think so. I mean, I think a good way to think about Trump and his tweets is he's kind of the nation's id. So he's very much the intense reaction. I mean, that's what he's giving voice to in these tweets. And he's said things on both sides of this issue. We will immediately attack, more or less. And, well, never mind. It may or may not happen. And, you know, this is the problem, especially when you get into diplomacy, because diplomacy traditionally has had certain protocols. Certain things that you do and don't do. Very much presidents get vetted. I mean, a lot of, I think, the shock of people who know how foreign policy works in the initial days of the Trump presidency, when those transcripts of the initial phone calls with heads of states were reached, was the fact that he seemed to be not taking into account the people who had vetted him or going in blind or just not taking advice likely. And that's kind of dangerous when we're talking about multiple actors in this kind of environment. And so here is where the rhetoric in tweets is probably qualitatively different than what you have, you know, in the domestic policy after he watches Fox and Friends typically. Those tend to be more domestic usually. That there can be real consequences from this. But at the same time, it's now being reported today that Trump wants to maybe rethink that TPP thing that he was against in the campaign and said we weren't going to do, but now maybe we will. So if you're a foreign leader trying to analyze the actions of the president, and you're using past presidential behavior in terms of other presidents here, I think you're scratching your head. Now, I think a lot of Trump supporters would say, yeah, that's right. That's exactly what we need. I'm not so sure that foreign policy experts would say that same thing.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, the president's tweet, we were talking about rhetoric earlier this week, the president answering a Russian threat to shoot down any U.S. missiles in Syria, tweeted, "Get ready, Russia, because they will be coming nice and new and smart. You shouldn't be partners with a gas-killing animal who kills his people and enjoys it." And this was pointed out by many media outlets. This is exactly what he criticized President Obama for doing, sort of broadcasting in advance military actions. So is this a head fake? What is this? What can we...
If you can't hear that on the radio, we're shrugging up here.
We have no idea what it means.
I would say here that, again, he's very reactionary. He's just reacting, and he's not necessarily thinking about what he's saying. And his persona is to be tough. Obama, in his view, was not tough. He wants to be tough, and this is the way that you can be tough. This is going to stop, and he uses, you know, the phrasing that he does, especially related to, you know, various regimes and people. And so I think, you know, again, he is just being very impulsive. And, you know, one of the things that I think repeatedly we see with Trump is that he goes with his gut, and his gut has got him where he is, and he trusts it. And even as we've seen people leave the administration who have been, you know, rather close advisors, it seems as if, you know, he still wants to go with his gut, and that may be why some of the people have left.
Well, and I guess sort of the frightening thing is that you keep reading these stories coming out of, you know, sort of anonymous sources at the White House saying that the trepidation they have is that there is no plan, there is no end game, there's no real strategy, that it's just sort of these kind of fits and starts and veering one way or the other and tweeting one thing. And you know, that's the dilemma, as you mentioned, for journalists. It's like, you cover this, but what does it mean? Is it impulsive, or is it, you know, like some of his supporters will say, he's playing 4D chess and this is all part of an elaborate, you know, strategy. I mean, who knows? Because it's like the TPP. I mean, one day you're getting rid of it, and then a year or so later you're bringing it back because the senator suggested it. I mean, he had the immigration meeting where he seemed to think, well, we're going to do all this immigration reform, and then a day later he's talking about asshole countries. So,
and that DACA later, is dead.
It's just, it's impossible to know what it means.
I think it's interesting that we know what he's thinking because he's tweeting it. We don't know what President Obama was thinking, or George Bush, or imagine what Dick Nixon would have done with Twitter. But, you know, I mean, we don't know that President Obama wasn't just as snarky and just as, you know, today I'm mad and tomorrow I'm going to be diplomatic and those sorts of things. The difference is that Trump is just putting it out there. We're confused by it, and I'm not sure that is, you know, that's probably part of his game, is keeping us confused.
Right.
To me, that's the difference, is we know what he's thinking.
I wanted to talk a little bit, you know, I had an interview last week with a Kyoto farmer who's president of the American Soybean Association, and he expressed the anxiety that soybean farmers are feeling, and I think pork producers are feeling, because of these escalating tariff threats between the United States and China. How concerned should people be that these are really going to happen? Is there too much at stake here for China and the U.S. for these things to go into effect, or how concerned should they be?
I guess it's not clear, and again, going back to, we don't know what this president is going to do on a day-to-day basis. There was another update. He'd met with some Midwestern governors and senators today, and they thought that the outcome of that meeting was positive, and these are mostly his allies, people who have endorsed him and defended him since then. I would like to see them take a much more aggressive stance. You know, they give up a lot of political capital for him. They've worked very hard to support the president, which left a lot of us scratching our heads. And, you know, what was the point of that if, on this one issue that really matters to your state, if you can't stand up and make what you want happen? So at this point, I still see most of the Iowa delegation playing nice with him, kind of trying to gently push him in the right direction. And I hope that if he, you know, keeps on this track towards more protectionism, I hope that we'll see them take a more aggressive stance.
I mean, if he's serious about revisiting if he's serious about taking on China, and is revisiting the TPP is probably a good idea, because that could have provided a framework for trade allies to sort of put multifaceted pressure on China, not just the United States versus China. But they threw that out in the beginning, and that, you know, didn't make a lot of sense at the time, but it was a campaign promise. He's renegotiating a lot of these deals. But you just don't know. Is what he said today actually what he's going to do? I mean, that's the biggest question. 2 days from now, he could denounce TPP, and I don't think anybody would be all that surprised.
But I might raise a point as to the political implications of this. I don't remember if it was last week or this week now, because things move so fast anymore. But at some point, Trump was quoted as saying, when someone asked him about, well, what about the effects that this may have on farmers, on agriculture, he was like, oh, well, farmers are patriots. They'll forgive me. He didn't quite say that, but he did say farmers are patriots and, you know, they'll be okay. And then people started approaching him about things that could be done in this sense. But, you know, I grew up on a farm in Oklahoma, and I remember very distinctly in 1980 when Carter slapped on a grain embargo on the Soviet Union. And that hurt farmers. And Carter was a farmer himself. And I think many farmers supported him in 76 that did not support him in 1980, because it is something that's a pocketbook issue. And I'm not sure that Trump has grasped that. And that's what, members of Congress from the Midwestern states in particular, agricultural states in particular, really need to make clear, is the impact. Whereas this is, you know, an attempt to punish China, it may also have another impact as well.
One more issue of national concern before we take a break to stretch our legs and refresh our pint glasses. Let's have you comment on the news this week that Paul Ryan, Speaker of the U.S. House, will complete his term, though there's
some controversy about that, or suggestions otherwise, about that after his announcement, will complete his term, but then not run for re-election. What that means? We had a very young, I mean, characterized a young Paul Ryan from our neighboring state, a man who set out on a mission to sort of redo fiscally how this country operates in the tax system. Compare what his vision was for as a young congressman from Wisconsin with what happened in fact as he rose through the ranks and became the U.S. Speaker of the House. Donna, perhaps you can start us off.
Yeah, I don't think that Ryan enjoyed being Speaker of the House. I think that was pretty clear. And I think the longer he served there, the more compromised his legacy was going to be. He was able to accomplish the tax cuts. It's shaping up that the midterm elections may not be particularly good for Republicans. Speakers of the House oftentimes get kind of sucked into that in terms of, you know, how did the party do? And he chose to leave. And, Ryan has had to be quiet in a lot of ways, I think, because he was known as a deficit hawk for much of his career. He was chair of the budget committee, but the tax cut actually adds quite a bit to the budget. And so Ryan wanted to tackle entitlement reform. He was unable to do that. And so I think his legacy is a pretty complicated one, because before Trump was the nominee, he was critical of Trump. Before the election, he was somewhat critical of Trump, but then he fell in line. And I think he's leaving in part because it's Trump's party now, and conservatism has changed, and it's Trump's Republican reactionary kind of politics at the moment. And I think Ryan was uncomfortable being in that environment.
I think on your question, Ben, I think clearly he failed at those goals that you described, but that's really common, right? Every so often there's these charismatic, passionate folks who with a big vision who come along, and they're not able to achieve that. And another good example would be Barack Obama, right? So he had very big ideas. I don't know that he left Washington much better than he came there.
Well, I have to...
He started more wars.
I have to actually give a little respect to Paul Ryan. He is in a job he didn't want, and he's saying, I'm not going to stay. And I guess I applaud him for that. Politically, things weren't going to get any better for him. I mean, if the tax cuts were the high point of his tenure as speaker, things are only going to get worse from here on out. So it's probably a good time to leave. He's got kids at home he wants to spend some time with. He's a smart, physically fit guy. He's got a good career ahead of him. That PX90 or whatever.
Yes, exactly.
He's ready to go.
Well, yeah, he is relatively young. So what's he going to do next?
Probably make more money than he makes now.
Yeah.
Cash in.
A job at a factory in Janesville.
I think the governor of Wisconsin can put in a good word and get him a job at Kohl's.
There you go.
Scott Walker always talked about going to Kohl's, so.
Maybe he'll run for governor.
Maybe he can get into cheese or sausage or beer. I hear there's something like Wisconsin, so.
After a short break, we return to our discussion recorded last evening before an audience of about 200 at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. Our panelists, columnists Todd Dorman and Adam Sullivan, as well as political reporter James Lynch of the Gazette. Also our special guest, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. By the way, our next Pints and Politics event will be held Thursday evening, May 10th, at Big Grove in Iowa City. Put that date on your calendar. It's lots of fun. We hope to see you there. Thursday evening, May 10th, Big Grove in Iowa City. As you can hear, we have a great time chewing over politics and having a pint. After a short break, we'll return to focus on state politics with our panel. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a Pints and Politics edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, coming to you from Cedar Rapids, from CSPS. So happy happy to be with my co-host once again, Aaron Jordan of The Gazette. Also, we have other panelists. Aaron, remind us of who we have this evening.
Great. Well, our panelists, we have our special guest, Donna Hoffman, UNI political science professor, Todd Dorman, Gazette political editor, James Lynch, Gazette political reporter, and Adam Sullivan, Gazette columnist. And I wanted to let you guys know, because we had a couple people ask, Linda Waddington just couldn't be here tonight. She will be at the next Pints in Politics, so yes. Never fear.
We love Linda. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
So I want to start off, we've got a ton of good
questions, have a lot of great
here
questions
for
here.
Our state and local portion. So I was just looking today at the schedule for the 2018 legislative session, and they said it's supposed to end like Tuesday. Next week. It seems like there's a lot left to do. Could you guys talk a little bit about what you see realistically happening?
They're going to do tax cuts, they're going to do the budget, and that might be it. April 17th is the day that their daily expense money runs out. It's not a hard deadline. There is no hard deadline for the legislature. They can keep going as long as they want to, pay their own way, and but usually, the 100th day when their money runs out, that's sort of an incentive to wrap things up. And then the other factor is the end of the month is coming, and that means that if they aren't finished by then, they have to renew their leases on apartments or whatever. And in some cases, those apartments won't be available in May, so then they really have to scramble.
There'll be a tent city.
Yeah, yeah.
Capitol Ground. A lot of the state house.
They'll call it Reynoldsville or something.
So dig down a little deep. Perhaps, Adam, you can help us out on this tax cut, because for those, I guess, casually following the news of the legislature, we had a shortfall in revenue in the state, had late budget cuts that were, well, the public universities were cut drastically there. But now we have this proposal for, depending on which chamber you're talking about, something like $1.7 billion. Is it over 5 years? The thinking behind that by Republicans that, and I know Governor Reynolds made a point in her condition of the state address to say, we will not become sort of do the Kansas model, which is, yeah.
Part of it is that with the federal, the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, there's some things they need to couple or decouple to, they don't want folks' tax bills to go up with the federal tax reform. And so there's some things that they feel like they really need to do. And there's some things that they want to do to cut taxes. My observation is that, I mean, all along, there's been bills floating around for a couple of months now, but no one's really had a sense of what had a real chance to make it in. And so my worry is that they're going to pass something that I'm going to like a lot of what's in the bill, but there's not going to be adequate time for folks to drill down and see what's actually in the bill that's going to get passed. And I'm also really skeptical that part of the way that they're going to replace some of the revenue that they're missing from income tax reform is they're going to apply sales tax to a bunch of new stuff, in particular online services, Uber, Airbnb. I think we need to have a broader public conversation about if and how those things need to be taxed. I think there's legitimate points, but I think that's something that Iowans deserve to have the chance to research and discuss. Because once we tax those things, we're not going to not tax them, right? And I think there's a real threat that cuts down on the entrepreneurial economy that we've seen kind of spring up over the last 5 and 10 years.
One of the arguments for taxing those things, of course, is tax fairness. That if you buy a book at the bookstore next door here, you pay sales tax on it. If you buy it from an online bookseller, you may not. You're supposed to declare that when you do your Iowa income taxes. But sometimes you forget that you bought that book, and those sorts of things. So it's often framed as a matter of tax fairness for Main Street, which for a lot of people in Iowa, a lot of voters, that makes sense. If you buy a book, you should pay sales tax or not, but it shouldn't depend on where you buy it. So that's an issue. And then you get into the whole video, audio streaming, Spotify, Netflix, Hulu, those sorts of things. And an argument against taxing those is that you're already paying a tax on your cable bill. So if you're getting Netflix through cable, you're already being taxed on it, and you shouldn't have to pay another tax on that. But that's part of both the House and Senate plans for tax reform to tax the new economy?
This is a question from the audience. You know, so in Governor Reynolds' condition of the state address, she had said that some things need to be fixed with Medicaid. And she there was a bill that was signed last week that I believe provides DHS oversight of cases when the managed care organizations aren't paying for services. But it seems like there's still a lot of issues that might need some addressing. So how do you see the gubernatorial candidates that are out there right now proposing to fix this?
Well, so far, I mean, most of the Democratic candidates have said that they want to roll back privatization, go back to a state-controlled Medicaid structure. Fred Hubble was in meeting with our editorial board a couple weeks ago, and he talked about sort of a hybrid arrangement where you'd have some of it under managed care, some of it as a pay-for-service, sort of the old Medicaid system. He pointed to states like Minnesota, I believe, that Connecticut, that have systems that he says are doing better than what Iowa's doing. You've got, at the other end of the spectrum, I think you've got like Kathy Glosson and some candidates that are talking about Medicaid for all, which everyone would be eligible for Medicaid. So there's a lot of points on that spectrum. And, you know, matters for the administration, for the Reynolds administration, became sort of even dicier today this week when the head of the DHS talked about these complaints from people on the Medicaid system as comparing them to people with lost luggage on airlines, which I don't think, I envision a protest at some point where lots of empty luggage will be thrown in front of the DHS or somewhere. I mean, that's not exactly the analogy that you want to use when people are ill and not getting the care that they need. Lost luggage didn't quite ring appropriate with most ears who heard it. So
you know, you're saying that a lot of the Democratic candidates for governor have the same position of rolling back this privatization. This leads to another question from the audience. How are the Democratic candidates for governor kind of narrowing the field, distinguishing themselves from one another?
Yeah, that's been sort of the issue, is that no one has...
I mean, if anybody knows, let us.
Yeah, right. There are the traditional measures. There's money, and there's maybe a little bit of polling here and there, but nobody has emerged as the clear front runner among those candidates, and we're getting closer to the primary, and there's this prospect that if nobody gets, you know, enough votes, that they'll have to go to a convention, which I think a lot of Democrats are worried about.
Yeah, it seems to be that they're, I think, intentionally maybe keeping their elbows close rather than throwing elbows at one another, because if they go to a convention, they don't want anybody to hate them. They're all trying to play nice, which makes it hard to decide which one you do like sometimes. And, you know, at county conventions, when was that, like a couple weeks ago, talking to people there, a lot of undecided. Obviously, there are some people who have, you know, chosen a candidate and are, you know, really enthusiastic about them, but there seems to be a lot of undecided folks, and I think the candidates maybe are counting on that because they think it may go to a convention.
There's a couple of the kind of lower candidates who no one thinks has a real shot. They're probably holding on because they want their endorsement to mean something down the line, or if it does go to convention, there's kind of some maneuvering they can do to secure themselves a hypothetical job in the hypothetical administration. So when you see those candidates that you're like, well, that person's not going to win, there are still some political reasons that they might stay in the race.
It's a Pints and Politics edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with my co-host Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. We're here with Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, our special guest on this edition. Also, James Lynch, Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan, our standbys, our veteran columnists and reporter in James's case here before an audience of a couple hundred people at Cedar Rapids, CSPS, and we're enjoying pints, locally produced brew, and locally produced political opinions to match that as well. Aaron, I'd like to go to the controversial Sanctuary Cities Bill that was signed this week by Governor Reynolds. It met a contentious debate in the State House. We had several talk shows on River to River about this.
I would like to get the panel's view here. One specific aspect of it that I've been looking into or hearing about in the news is the fact that our local law enforcement maybe are questioning whether what they're being asked to do, which is to hold people that ICE wants to detain for no other reason than ICE wanting to detain them. That is a constitutional issue, I think. How do you see this bill being put into force with so many reservations from local law enforcement?
I think we're going to see some heads butt. I think sheriffs in very conservative areas have a way of doing things. They haven't been immigration hounds. I don't think they're going to start doing that. I think you could see the legislature come back next year and say they don't like what these sheriffs are doing and try to even give this more teeth. But we're kind of in uncharted territory, right? Iowa hasn't had a bill like this before or law like this now. And I do think it is an example of central and western Iowa Republicans kind of trying to stick it to eastern Iowa communities, Iowa City in particular. So I live in a sanctuary city. We don't call it that there, but we have a sanctuary-ish policy, and it's been fine. It's not like immigrants are taking over the town or something, which would be fine if they did.
It's been an interesting process to watch because they had subcommittee hearings and public hearings on this, and one of the things, law enforcement who testified almost unanimously were opposed to the bill. Said that, the police chief from Storm Lake, for example, came in and said, this is going to make my job harder because it's a matter of trust, and this is going to break down the trust between the community and the immigrant community and the police and the immigrant community. You had the police chief from Iowa City there who said, we're not a sanctuary city. In fact, just last week, ICE was at the jail to pick up someone who was being detained there. None of that seemed to matter because in a way, this really isn't about sanctuary cities at all and about immigrants and being illegal or undocumented or whatever you want to call them. It's political. Governor Reynolds has been raising funds off this issue, and I'm sure we're going to see it in a whole lot of campaign ads over the summer and this fall. It's all about politics because there's no problem here.
So I wanted to hit on, we had heard quite a bit earlier on in the session just about how the GOP was addressing sexual harassment allegations. So this is a question from the audience, just as background before I get to the question. The director of the Iowa Finance Authority, David Jamieson, was fired after a sexual harassment complaint last month. We've seen some other, kind of actions taken. So the question from the audience is, what is the status of sexual harassment review and things like that at the State House?
A clerk in the Senate just got fired because of a sexual harassment complaint. We really don't know much about that. We don't know much about the David Jamieson case either, other than there were credible allegations, but we don't know what they were or what credible means. But, they hired a human resources officer. They've done some training, which is, typical of what a lot of businesses do. Yeah, beyond that, no, I don't know that there's anything really going on in terms. Obviously, there is a process for complaints. As I said, somebody filed a complaint and a clerk was fired as a result of that. There hasn't really been much talk or discussion about that. It's just sort of like, okay, he's gone. Beyond that, not really hearing a whole lot about it.
I would expect that you're going to continue to see these situations, and it's easy to look at that and be upset about it, but these things have been going on for a long time. So men, and it is almost entirely men, have been doing bad things for thousands of years. And no, but really, but this is the first time in this country, the past several months or the past year, where as a society we've started to take it more seriously, right? But I think there's going to be growing pains. I think that we're going to see several years of this where we do have these embarrassing situations, but I think we're getting better, and we still have a lot of problems. But I think ultimately the fact that these things are coming out is a sign of progress.
I'm just wondering about the clapping after you said Men have been doing bad things for thousands of years.
Well, so men are the ones who do sexual assaults. Men are the ones who start wars. Men are the ones who get into fights. And there are exceptions, but there are exceptions that prove the rule, right?
Finishing up our session, it's sad that it goes so quickly each time we have our panelists together here at CSPS. James Lynch, Aaron Jordan, my co-host, Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan. It's a Pints and Politics edition of River to River. Getting to some more audience questions, a couple hundred people in our audience here at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. Let me do this question, Aaron, that is sort of straddling local and national politics. The questioner asks, will Joni Ernst face stiff competition and be reelected? Now, that is not coming in 2018. This is she was elected in 2014, right? That memorable face-off with Congressman Braley. So 2020 coming up. Thoughts on Joni Ernst? I guess this question may be there also put there with the context of the gun violence across the country and the protests, especially by young people in this country, that nothing is being done effectively against gun violence.
Well, and I think connecting the two, there's also been criticisms of Joni Ernst's level of support from the NRA.
I haven't heard any sort of early trial balloons on anyone that's going to challenge Joni Ernst. I mean, you hear names batted around. I know there are people that are hoping, you know, somehow that, like, maybe Tom Vilsack will come back from Colorado and challenge her or something like that. But I haven't heard anyone really mentioned as a serious, or anyone that's trying to, like, lay groundwork at this point.
No, I expect she'll have a challenge. I think she'll be very hard to beat. She's done a lot of things really well. You know, if you look at Joni Ernst today compared to sort of her delivery and sort of thing when she ran, she's much more polished. She's been very busy introducing legislation with people from both parties on a lot of issues. She's going to be very hard to beat.
Well, and she kind of came in with a high media profile, and there was sort of this speculation, is she going to, you know, do the work of a senator? Is she going to become like sort of Steve King and be on cable news a lot and then making a lot of pronouncements on issues of the day and building her national profile? And I think she's actually sort of done the work of being a senator and laid the groundwork for actual legislation and has performed fairly well. Don't agree with everything she's done, but I think she's taken a better path than sort of being, you know, a Fox News talking head.
You made the connection to the gun issue, and I think what remains to be seen is if swing voters start voting based on that issue, that they want to see more gun control. I don't think we have seen it. I'm skeptical that we will, and I'm more skeptical that as far out as 2020 that will still be a major driving issue that swing voters are going to decide based on. But I think, I don't know what's going to happen in politics next week, so I certainly don't know what's going to happen in 2020.
Don't admit that.
Don, I want to talk to you about Joni Ernst. I see her often, frequently in photo ops with the president, for instance, and this is a rising star in the Republican Party. What do you see as Joni Ernst's possible political future here? I mean, and how the Republican Party sees her?
Well, I think the Republican Party definitely sees her as a rising star, but she's a first-term senator. We know from political science research, thank you, that the first re-election that you have is your toughest. She has done a lot of groundwork to make that a little easier for her, but so she has a challenge there. It will be 2020. It will be a presidential election year. But I would expect a serious Democratic challenge. I don't know who that would be. Because if we've learned anything over the last couple of, or the last year, Roy Moore was a shoe-in in Alabama, but he had a serious Democratic challenger, and that turned out okay for the Democratic challenger. Paul Ryan has just retired, and he was already being challenged by a serious Democratic challenger that now looks a little more serious. And Paul Ryan was going to win, don't get me wrong, but there was somebody in place to not make it an unopposed race. And so I think you are seeing a lot more Democrats, just because of the nature of the cycle right now, who are, and in Texas, we know that whereas in previous cycles, a lot of state House races were going unopposed, there are many more Democrats who are challenging Republican incumbents who, in prior cycles, those incumbents waltzed in with no opposition. And so I think that the landscape going into 2020, which we don't exactly know what it is, except that it's going to be a presidential election year, is such that there will be a serious Democratic challenge, and Joni Ernst will have to run a race. But she's done the things as a senator, and it, rather than being a show horse, she's been a workhorse, as we like to say sometimes. And that means that she's incumbents are generally a good bet for reelection. But I do think that she has to continue to pay attention to what the landscape is. And also, if we know anything, we know that landscape can change pretty quickly. But if Trump is president in 2020, which I really expect him to be, and I also expect him to run for election, to run for reelection, that is then a concern if he continues to be unpopular and she has photo ops with him and she has done various things in which any serious Democratic opponent can tie her to an unpopular president. And that can be really problematic for a first-term senator in that kind of environment.
And that winds up Pints and Politics, recorded yesterday evening at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. Once again, I'll mention our next Pints and Politics event will be held Thursday evening, May 10th, at Big Grove in Iowa City. So put that date on your calendar, Thursday evening, May 10th, Big Grove in Iowa City. Hope to see you there. As you can hear, we have a lot of good times while chewing over politics. Our producer and audio editor today, Emily Woodbury. Our sound engineer, Jim Davies. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.